So I saw this title cartoon. So I was thinking about my lecture. See, already models in condensed matter or any system, any branch of science are supposed to be caricatures, cartoons of reality. And what I find is I'm doing making cartoons of cartoons. So it starts looking like abstract art. In the last couple of lectures, I have touched upon bosons in condensation, weakly interacting Bose gas, and then a little bit about helium-4 superfluidity, and then I came to superconductors. So the caricature model is weakly interacting Bose gas, in which the bosons are repelling each other at short distance. So, which can be represented by delta function repulsion, just one parameter, namely strength of the repulsion. And then I motivated Hartree-Bogoliubov mean field theory, where you assume, inspired by the non-interacting situation, namely bosons in condensed state, that there is macroscopic occupation in the lowest state, namely zero momentum state. So, which means the creation and annihilation operators can be replaced by C numbers because they suffer very small, they behave like classical variables. So once you do that, you are reducing an interacting problem into a non-interacting problem, in which strange things like spontaneously a pair of particles come out of the vacuum and disappear with some amplitude. And that amplitude is related to the order parameter, which needs to be calculated self-consistently, using variational theory or energy minimization procedures. So that was the crux of the thing that I was telling in the first lecture. Then in the second lecture, I went to superconductivity. There again, we went to a cartoon model, namely BCS model, where you assume the simplest of fermion system, namely free Fermi C. And then motivated by the work of Frohlich and others, you say that there is a weak interaction between electron and the lattice, and that leads to attractive interaction between the electrons when they scatter close to the Fermi surface. So there is a complicated dependence of the interaction on the momentum transfer and so on, but we replaced it by a simplest shell model in which you say that there is an energy shell around the Fermi surface in which attractive interaction is taking place independent of momentum. And then in particular, you choose only scattering of particles that carry net momentum 0. You may remember that I had an expression like this. So this is around some shell. So you notice that a pair of particles with 0 momentum gets scattered to another state k minus k with the net momentum 0. So this is again an idealization. I have thrown away all the other state terms which correspond to pairs traveling with finite center of mass momentum and getting scattered. Even this is non-trivial. It captures the essence of superconductivity. That's the beginning of BCS theory. So I alluded to that. Then today, what I thought was I will do one thing concretely, a simple derivation, which is also related to Landau theory of phase transition, Ginzburg-Landau theory, and things you will come across in quantum field theory, deriving effective field theories and so on. So I will just indicate it. In the condensed matter language, this is often called Hubbard-Stratonovich identity and Hubbard-Stratonovich trick. So I will do that in detail. Before I do that, I wanted to summarize to you, because today is a quantum day, quantum world day, what are all the fascinating things that are there around superfluid and superfluidity as a phenomena. Yesterday, we said there is Meissner effect, zero resistivity, and flux quantization. Now, there is also a phenomena called Josephson effect, which was a very fascinating story. Young Josephson was a student at Cambridge doing experimental physics with Brian Pippard. And then there was Phil Anderson giving a lecture. He said, if you look at the BCS wave function, you remember I wrote it like this. This is a BCS wave function. There is a mysterious phase, that is, you can replace this by I theta. And then you notice the final energy is independent of this theta. So there is a hidden degree of freedom, namely phase variable, which is independent. So for example, you can also 2 theta. You can imagine doing a transformation of C to e to the power of I theta, the creation annihilation operators, and then it will get annihilated by this. So you can account, observe the exchange through. So this is related to the U1 symmetry breaking in superconductivity. This is something I should have mentioned, I forgot to mention. U1 symmetry tells about the total particle number conservation in the system. So that is a simple statement of the facts. In second quadrant notation, suppose you have a collection of particles which are hopping plus Hermitian conjugate, then you notice that there is a symmetry that I can take Ci, replace it by e to the power of I theta sigma, a global phase. And then I do it for every I, the same phase. So the theta will cancel with minus theta coming from here. So this is just a statement that the total particle number commutes with the Hamiltonian. So this is a famous U1 conservation. Now, once you have a scattering term like this, so called Bogoliubov scattering term, you notice that the U1 phase, yeah.
When we say the U1 conservation is particle number symmetry, I see how, like, when you write some Hamiltonian in second quantum notation, you count the daggers, count the things without daggers. I guess that makes a U1 symmetry. But how, like, does it kind of go the other way? Like, if I see a U1 symmetry in a condensed matter Hamiltonian, does that mean that underlyingly there is particle number conservation somewhere else?
There is explicitly particle number conservation. Now, when I do Bogoliubov theory of superconductivity, I by hand break the particle number conservation symmetry, because this term tells me out of vacuum, two electrons can come out, and two electrons can disappear when they carry zero momentum and with this amplitude. So if I do a phase transformation, I am left with the phase unless I absorb it by changing the phase of this delta. So that means my effective Hamiltonian has less symmetry than the original Hamiltonian. So this is a statement of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the system spontaneously chooses one phi. So this was the question that Phil Anderson asked. So he said, in this BCS wave function, the system spontaneously chooses one phi. Does it have any experimental consequences? The story is, he is supposed to have remarked that suppose it is indeed true that this phase is something important, then it should have experimental consequences. So he said, suppose I have two superconductor, BCS superconductor, characterized by phi 1 and phi 2, phase phi 2, which are weakly coupled. Like I have two lead superconductors with a thin oxide film so that there is a quantum mechanical tunneling possible. Then Anderson realized, he said that if this is the case, then there is a phase difference. The phase difference is between two wave functions, macroscopic wave function. Now we know that phase difference in quantum mechanics means current. So if there is a phase difference, there should be a current flowing between the two. And the current is going to be a periodic function of phi, because this phi is a modulo 2 pi variable. So he's supposed to have written down in the blackboard, J is equal to J naught And we suppose we have written it down that if we bring two superconductors having different phase, there should be a current that should be flowing spontaneously, which is determined by the phase difference between the two superconductors. Then, having said that, Anderson rubbed it off and forgot about it. And young Josephson, sitting in the audience, noted it down in his notebook and thought about it and derived it and showed it to Anderson. And Anderson was very impressed and he said, please go ahead and publish it. This is a new effect that you have discovered. That is the story behind Josephson effect. So, where the phase of the order parameter, which looks mysterious from mathematics point of view, becomes a reality in terms of phase difference when you do an experiment. Yes.
How do we know, like, why is it a spontaneous symmetry breaking instead of, because classically you have, like, in the classical theory of particles, if you study the fluid like that, you would have number conservation. Like, why do we know
exactly
that symmetry breaking instead of an anomaly for that?
So it's a very good question. So let me start with an example of a magnet. Suppose I take spins, quantum spins. They, let's say I have spin half moment forming a cubic lattice. So the spins are antiferromagnetically coupled. Now, your classical intuition tells you that when you have a big enough system at zero temperature, there will be antiferromagnetic order. One sublattice spins will be up, other sublattice spins will be down, so that they end. So that's a good classical picture. But if you take two spins which are antiferromagnetically coupled through exchange interaction, the famous, you know that the ground state is a superposition like this, a singlet state. So there is strong quantum fluctuation. Okay? Now there is no spontaneity because it is both are, now you make it bigger and bigger. Instead of two, then it turns out when you have a chain of spins which are interacting, there is no long range order. There is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. But you have a plane, or if you have cubic lattice. So this is related to the theorem called Lieb-Schultz theorem. Suppose I have two n spins forming a big cubic lattice with Avogadro number of spins. Let us say I have a periodic boundary condition. According to this theorem, the ground state, which is unique, is a singlet, it is a total spin singlet. But then, where is the spontaneous symmetry breaking? That is a question that you are asking. The ground state is a singlet according to, but however, there are many, many low energy states, very soft states, you can form coherent superposition of them, and then they will be astronomically long lived. So, that is a spontaneous symmetry. That means what you need is a tiny symmetry breaking field to polarize the spins in an antiferromagnetic order. The same way in a ferromagnet, in the paramagnetic state, all the spins are classically fluctuating. But below transition temperature, even a tiny, tiny field will choose order this way or this way, depending on which way you operate the field. Okay. So that susceptibility.
So the symmetry breaking happens because we are like
adding a
forming the
Hamiltonian.
Okay.
But then finally make it go to zero. So it's like this. So in fact it's an important point.
If we plot the only symmetry breaking that we've studied is like the Higgs.
I will come to it. So suppose I take a ferromagnet at finite temperature, above transition temperature, the magnetization as a function of field will be like this, right? Because as I apply more field, there will be polarization instead of thermal fluctuations. Depending on the direction of the field, the magnetization will change in direction. Below TC, some miracle happens. So, if you start with positive field and then come down, as H tends to 0 plus, the magnetization remains finite. If you start with negative field, as H tends to 0 minus, it becomes minus M. So this is spontaneous symmetry breaking. So you are right. I apply a small field, it responds, then even if I take the field, it remains. So it's like an anomaly. You know, in quantum field theory, you learn about anomaly. You add a term and then remove it. As long as you approach zero from one direction, for arbitrarily small values, it will remain. So that is what is supposed to happen in a superconductor. Now, how do you rationalize this number of fluctuations and phase in a superconductor? Yes? You had a question?
Sorry. Keep going. It'll probably be answered.
So suppose you remember I told you about the Bose gas. When I wrote down non-interacting Bose gas at zero temperature, the wave function for the Bose gas is identical for every configuration because it was independent of position. That means if you focus on a small volume, then I will find numbers, configurations having different numbers having identical phase. So there is something about the phase coherence. If at the same time I take Fermi system, suppose I take a collection of n fermions in the ground state that form a slated determinant, then I consider a small volume. You know that in Fermi's when fermion system, as you move the particle, often they will encounter nodal surfaces because of antisymmetry. Because, yeah, this is a very important point. So this is a statement of antisymmetry. I interchange the coordinates. So when I have n coordinates, n particles, then when I change the coordinates, the wave function. So if you go to configuration space, which is 3n-dimensional for n particle, and then move in the configuration space, whenever I will encounter planes, nodal planes, many of them. So the wave function will be very chaotic in the sense as I move in configuration space, they will change sign and become zero. Whereas in the case of bosons, that is not true. Whatever when I move in configuration space coherently, the phases hardly change. So that is the meaning of real phase coherence. That has implications in terms of superfluidity and so on. Yes.
When you say coherence, do you mean like we should think of it as a pure state and not a thermal state? Or
exactly. So I look at the coherent part of the thermal state. So in fact, if you take bosons in condensed state, there is finite temperature, there is depletion of condensate. But in that, there is a quantum coherence sitting even at finite temperature below TC. That is the same thing about superconducting. In fact, if people do Josephson effect or look at macroscopic quantum phenomena in a superconductor, they do it at room temperature these days, or let us say 10 Kelvin. There is thermal background, but in spite of that, some quantum mechanics has survived at macroscopic scale, and that is what is leading to Josephson phenomena of flux quantization and so on. So that is not possible with pure fermions. If you pair fermions, they can start behaving like bosons. And we will see it later, when you do things, there are things like anions which is new things that are coming in correlated system. Yes.
If the wave function is antisymmetric, the way I understand it is that there will be some points when x1 equals x2,
yeah,
that it will vanish.
You will have to cross that, yeah.
So you'll create some sort of, like, if you think of the function as a complex function, you'll create some sort of boundary.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. And then, so there's no long scale correlation of the material.
Exactly. So let me look at it. Let me case the case of two particles in one dimension, just two particles in one dimension. So the configuration space is this. This is the x1 coordinate of particle 1. If I look at the wave function of, I can imagine this to be a circle, form x1 and x2 form a circle. Then for the case of bosons, wherever I am, the wave function has identical phase. Whereas in the case of fermion, the phase has to change. The wave function will be, if it is positive in this direction, it's negative in this, so it's called the nodal plane. So when x1 equal to x2, the wave function vanishes. So if I traverse in configuration space, I come across one nodal plane. Now, if you have many, many particles, there will be many, many nodal planes. So, in that sense, antisymmetric wave function, even though it looks very simple, like a slated determinant, it has a lot of phase variations in configuration space. However, if you take fermions and then move them in pair in configuration space, then you will find similar phenomena like this happening. Yeah, you had a question.
Sorry, I don't have a question.
It's very important because it's a very basic point.
Yeah.
Because we are using coordinate, like one state, for example, in a hydrogen atom is nodeless in the radial function. Then 2a state has a node, 3a state has three nodal planes and so on. So that is not coming from antisymmetry, that is just coming from quantum mechanics. When you have many particles, there are nodal planes coming in configuration space, like this two-dimensional configuration space, forced by symmetry of the wave function. And what is remarkable is, in interacting bosons, there are nodal planes that are coming because of correlations. Whenever two particles come close by, the wave function has to vanish. But there is no nodal plane attached to it. It's not that I take two particles, go around it, the sign doesn't change. Whereas in the case of fermion, the sign will change. So even when they are away, they have to cross the nodal plane if they move around. So please check with some couple of particle wave function in one dimension and two dimension, you will enjoy it. This is something that we are not normally taught.
Phenomenologically, I have two fermions and two bosons, let's say, and I recognize the nodal plane here. And so somehow like this, I think of it as like a sort of like phase difference, maybe local phase difference, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So there is an intrinsic phase difference in Fermi system.
But so can I couple to the phase difference an external probe?
Exactly.
And how does that exactly work?
That is the vector potential. So what happens is these objects carry charge, right? Let's say take a superconductor. So electrons carry charge. So I have to move the electron around, accelerate it, and change the phase, create a local current. How can I do it? I can do it through electric field or magnetic field. So there will be a general vector potential phi r a, which will do that. So the response to vector potential or external perturbation will be in terms of phase change of the wave function. Yeah, in fact, you know, you can imagine a ring. This is called a Bohm-Mohr. Suppose I have a ring, the particle is in zero momentum state. Now I force a flux through the ring, even though the particle is not feeling the flux, through Bohm-Mohr effect, it will acquire a momentum. Please solve this one particle problem in the presence of a flux. The energy will go up and come down. So that means there will be a ground state current corresponding to that flux. Yeah, let me elaborate. It is a very important point. I take a particle in around, then I imagine threading a flux. So this is a Bohm-Mohr flux. So Bohm-Mohr effect tells me that if I plot the ground state energy of this particle as a function of flux, for zero flux, the ground state energy is zero because the particle is delocalized. So what is the energy? Energy is h cross square by the 2m roughly, where L is the size of the ring. So energy is zero, zero momentum state. Now I apply a magnetic field, then this will appear through a vector potential in quantum mechanics. This is in two dimension, I convert it into angular coordinates. Then what I will find is, I will find the energy as in the ground state as a periodic variation as a function of phi, with fundamental quanta hc over e. So what does it mean? It means the particle responds to external magnetic field through Bohm-Mohr effect and carries a current here. So the gradient of phase is the current. So there is a ground state current. Here the current is zero. Here there is a finite current, zero and so on. So this is what happens. This is how the wave function develops phase variation. So you can imagine that happening in a superconductor pairwise. So pairs of particles which are correlated, their phase varies, and that is where supercurrent flow comes. Okay, so let's see, where am I?
This is in the presence of a four potential or for like
vector potential. So this is the famous Bohm-Mohr experiment. Suppose I have a ring which carries, in fact, people have done beautiful experiments with mesoscopic rings. You can create a semiconductor ring in which you inject few electrons and they form a quantum state. And then imagine applying a magnetic field through a solenoid. So the particles are not feeling the magnetic field at all. They are far away. There is no magnetic field at this point. But however, there is a Baumgarten flux, because in quantum mechanics, it occurs through e to the power of I in closed loop A integral. This is how it appears. So this is a mystery of Baumgarten effect. Yeah. So that's a so in fact in the in quantum in superconductor, the response to electrons is through this phase oscillation or corresponding currents. That's how quantized vertices are formed. Sorry, I have so many things to in superconductor. I am skipping many of them. I'm just giving you a skip. Yeah. So that takes me to what I wanted to say. Okay. So you asked the question about spontaneous symmetry breaking. So that's the meaning of this. So what you need is you need a small perturbation. For example, now you can ask the question: how can I realize it in reality? In fact, this was done with superfluid helium 4. What you do is, you take a bucket, of superfluid helium 4. When they are not connected, there is a finite number, because you can imagine a droplet, of a big droplet. There is no connection between them, the number remains the same. Then you make a connection, and what you find is you find a spontaneous oscillation in the ground state. It becomes like a time crystal. So, which is related to what is the phase that you started with. So, there are many mysterious things. So, in other words, what is happening is it is not a mysterious thing. If I take a superconductor, focus on a small volume, which is not microscopic but still mesoscopic, there is a coherent fluctuation of numbers going in and out, Cooper pairs going in and out. So that means locally I can define a sharp phase. So because when there is number fluctuation, phase becomes sharp. Because I'm sorry, this again is something I forgot. I should have mentioned number phase uncertainty. You have uncertainty relation between position and momentum. So in the same way, if we consider a harmonic oscillator, suppose I consider a harmonic oscillator characterized by creation and annihilation operator. So they have the famous commutation relation. Now, harmonic oscillators have excited states, equispaced. Imagine I am at a very highly excited state, some n equal to 200 or something, then I can form coherent superposition about 200 and 199, 198, 202, and so on, form a coherent superposition, and then make the number uncertain but the phase sharp. And that is a famous coherent state. Remember yesterday I was telling you this coherent state e to the power of minus alpha, not normalized. So what you do is, if you look at the magnitude of alpha, that will be related to the, so I can take this coherent state and I can calculate the probability of finding n particles in this state. Then that probability distribution, as I told you, will be looking like this. So, it will be sharply peaked around alpha square with a small difference. So, now I can say this state has a sharp phase related to the phase of this alpha, but number is fluctuating. So, there is a number phase uncertainty. So, in a superconductor, when you look at a small volume, the numbers are definitely fluctuating in pairs. Whereas, in the case of a normal metal, when I look at a small volume, number will be fluctuating because electrons will be. There is many, many configuration for us, but the phase will be oscillating tremendously. Here, since the particles are moving as pairs, as bosons, so there is a phase coherence. That's a local phase variable that we are talking about. Okay. So, this is the about number phase uncertainty. So, this also plays very important role in quantum mechanics. And in an oscillator also, you know, this becomes very, very important when you go to very highly excited state. Because then the problem becomes equispatial. It's like a problem of particle hopping on a lattice. When the particle is hopping on a lattice and the energies are identical, then you can form a wave packet in momentum state or in real space and then talk about momentum phase uncertainty or position uncertainty. Okay. So this is something that I wanted to do. So today, let's see what, yeah. I felt that I should tell you something that is a useful thing in, with which you can calculate, because this was a, one of the complaints that I am just a lot of doing hand waving thing I should do. So there is something called Hubbard Stratonovich identity, which was written down by Hubbard in 1959, the famous Hubbard model. It's a simple trick which is coming in field theory in a big way, and in fact this is used in quantum field theory without explicit mention. So what you do is you look at a Gaussian integral. So this is a Gaussian integral, normalized to unity. I can make change a variable, make it look like this, e to the power of minus pi x. So now what I do is, since I am integrating from minus infinity to plus infinity, I can shift the center of the Gaussian and then get this expression. So just rewriting this Gaussian integral after shifting the center, that is e to the power of minus pi is also 1. Now you can expand it and so on and then finally get this. So that means a Gaussian with a linear term can be regrouped and look like this. So now this can be used in making an interacting problem look non-interacting. And as a first step, you'll get mean field theory when you look at the saddle point. So this is the thing that I wanted to tell you today in some detail. So let me take some, I'm not taking superconductivity, I'm looking at cooperative phenomena involving Ising model, Ising spins. You all know what it is. That is, suppose I have a square lattice and I put a spin at every site. Let me call it as in the SI, which can take 2 value. Then there is some coupling between 2 neighboring spins, which is written as J. So since it's look Ising Pauli spin operator, we'll write it like this. So this is a model that I have to solve. Statistical mechanics of this ground state is very trivial, because if J is negative, that means I put a convention minus and then make positive, ground state will correspond to either all spins up or all spins down. So there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking in the ground state. It can choose all the spins are up or all the spins down. Then I want to do statistical mechanics of this. What do we mean statistical mechanics? I want to calculate partition function, sum over all possible spin value of this becomes J . So this is a famous partition function. If you solve it exactly, you will get free energy from which you can do. And normally what you do, also apply a magnetic field, external magnetic field, minus, to see how the system responds to magnetic field, whether there is spontaneous symmetry breaking and so on. So Ansager solved this problem for a 2-dimensional net of spins. And he became famous. Of course, in other ways he was also famous. Ansager solved this problem analytically using what is called transfer matrix method. And I told you about quantum spin chain, and that Hamiltonian or that operator corresponds to the transfer operator, that transfer matrix operator that Ansager discovered. I will not go into that detail. So this is what we want to solve. Turns out you can solve this problem trivially in 1 dimension. In fact, I leave it as an exercise to you. Suppose you take a collection of spins on a chain. You can systematically solve this and get the analytic expression for spins in a magnetic field with nearest neighbor coupling in 1 dimension. In 2 dimension, Ansager could solve it, and nobody could solve it in 3 dimension. So that's a Nobel Prize winning or a big prize winning open problem, solution of three-dimensional Ising model. And Polyakov has a conjecture in his book that it can be solved in terms of some string theory. So, in fact, there are people who have worked on it. So, I'll encourage you to look at Polyakov's book. Because this problem, which is in two-dimensional statistical mechanics problem, looks like a one-dimensional fermion problem. So, similarly, according to Polyakov, the three-dimensional statistical mechanics problem becomes a two-dimensional fermionic string problem. Fermionic strings living in two space dimension. And it's a conjecture, and there are lots of support for it, and there are arguments. So, it's one of the beautiful things in Polyakov's book. You may like to see that. Fermionic string, not bosonic string. Connection between 3D Ising model solution and fermionic strings. Okay. Now, I want to solve this problem. So, I cannot solve it exactly. So, can I solve it approximately and then get some idea about what is actually going on? So, long back, Weiss, while discussing magnetism, he developed what is called a mean field theory. What did Weiss do? He said that at very high temperature, spins are strongly quantum fluctuating, whereas if I go to low temperature, I have a spin, neighboring spins tend to order cooperatively. So, they provide some kind of mean field. Interaction between neighbors provides a mean field. So, what did Weiss do? He set up a simple scheme to calculate that mean field self-consistently. Suppose this spin is feeling a mean field, so that spin is also feeling the same mean field, then I got a self-consistent equation which exhibited phase transition. I will come to that in detail. So, now I want to do it in a formal way via saddle point analysis of this complicated partition function. And you will find on the way pi 4 field theory in Euclidean space emerging in a very beautiful way. This is what I will do in the rest of the 5 minutes. Time flies, you know. I can share with you the joke. Let me ask you the question. What is the speed of time?
Second per second. Hmm? 1 second per second.
You know, it's the velocity of light. Because if you write down space-time coordinate, this is my own PJ. In relativity, you write x, y, z, comma c, t. So, you take the derivative of x, you get velocity in the x direction, z direction. In the time direction, you get c. No wonder it flies very fast. Anyway, sorry for the joke. Okay. So, now…
I have one question about these phase transitions, because I think that what I don't understand is there that phase transition… Like, when we are turning a temperature, a finite temperature, like, the phase transitions that we studied in statistical mechanics are not quantum.
No, that's thermal. In fact, whatever Hansager did is classical statistical mechanics, because the ground state, all spins are up or all spins are down. Then you heat it up. There will be thermal fluctuation, because a flip of one spin costs 2j, because there are 4 neighbors, you can compute it. So, there is some probability for it to happen through Boltzmann factor. And when you increase the temperature, there are many of them. So, they will break up into domain, and what is remarkable is, it was shown by Pyles, that this will happen as a cooperative phenomena. This is a very, very important point. It is not obvious that when you heat it up, there will be a sharp phase transition. This is a famous argument due to Pyles. In fact, I will tell Emily to do it in the classes. Beautiful argument due to Pyles that a phase transition will exist if you have a two-dimensional net of spins, not in one dimension. That's a very beautiful argument. And three-dimensional, it does exist. So, whatever I'm talking about is classical fluctuations, thermal phase transition. Now, very often we talk about quantum phase transition as you change some coupling constant, but there is a relation between the two. Now, what I wanted to do is to solve Ising model using Hubbard-Sutton identity. You can do it in saddle point approximation. Basic idea is, yeah, let me just write it down and then leave it at that, because I don't want you to miss the World Quantum Day meeting. So please note this identity. I wanted this to come. Okay, this. I'm sorry. I will use it. So it's a very, very powerful identity, which reduces a two-body interaction to one-body interaction. That's what we do in Hartree-Fock theory. But this identity will tell you that this Hartree-Fock potential will be fluctuating. So essentially, it says, suppose I have using the so this is the what you come across. Suppose I have some k is j by kt and some interaction between neighboring spins. Let me put a general range. This can be simply written using the Hubbard-Stratonich identity I said before, in terms of sum over or integral over some auxiliary variable phi I e to the power of minus phi I phi j k I j times Si. Okay. So what did we have? We had interaction between two spin variables. Now I have just rewritten it using that identity, that spin is interacting with some fluctuating field. That fluctuating field is governed by this Gaussian factor, and I integrate it. So it's just an identity. Now I can start interpreting this phi's as Hartree-Fock field. So now I can use, for example, once I do this, it is very trivial to take trace with respect to spin variable. The way in Bogoliubov theory, what did we do? We had no way of solving interacting problem. So we reduced the problem to non-interacting problem. Then we solved it in BCS theory also. The same way in the spin problem, there is no way of solving this interacting spin problem. We reduce this to a spin seeing some external magnetic field. Now how do I take trace with respect to simple? It will simply give me every term will give me when I take the trace with respect to the spin sigma. This will give me log cos, right? Log cos of Kij sum over all I. That's it. So sorry, cos. Then I exponentiate, it become log cos. So that means after I take the trace, it becomes plus so you notice that I have gotten rid of my sum over spins. Then I have got instead a complicated Gaussian integral, which looks like a Gaussian integral with some complicated log cos. You may remember this log determinant coming in field theory problems when you integrate over fermion determinants and so on. So it's analogous to that. Now if you look at this as a multidimensional continuous integral, there will be saddle points. And one saddle point will be the famous saddle point, which will give you this equation m equal to tan hyperbolic beta m which Weiss wrote down many years ago self-consistently. So when you say everything is appearing here, so when you look at it and look at the saddle point, you will get this. And there are many, many saddle points. So for example, if you have a complicated Kij, which is called frustrating, there are many, many saddle points. That is where spin glassiness and so on goes. So it's a very rich world altogether. But I have given you some idea about what is going on here. Okay, I will stop here because I promised quantum world people that I will.
One last question. Do the saddle points correspond to different phases of the system?
Sorry?
Do the different saddle points correspond to different phases of
exactly. So, for example, there could be a system in which there are many, many phases competing. They could be glassy. So they are called a frustrated system. Typically, for a ferromagnet, there will be one stable phase, one stable point. But then in the case of more complicated, for example, the interacting bosons in two dimension, the saddle point structure is very complicated. It's no more a uniform phase. It involves vertices, pairs of vertices. That's where the Casserly-Stavros physics comes. I will indicate it in the next class and then proceed.